So we're going to continue our study of Sefer Shoftim towards the end of the Sefer, and we're right in the middle of Perek Yotes, two-thirds of the way. We're up to Pasuk Chaf Aleph, and it is what ends up being the tragic story of Pilegesh Begiva. Up until this point, we wouldn't call it a tragedy yet, because nothing tragic happened. And we also wouldn't understand necessarily why the story gets known as Pilegesh Begiva, because we met the Pilegesh. We met the woman who is married to a man from the tribe of Levi, but they live in Har Ephraim. And they had some type of disagreement. She went back to her father's house, which was in Beis Lechem. And a few months passed, 4 months passed by. The husband, the Ish Levi, he goes back. He goes to get her to to reunite. And the father seems to be extremely happy about it. They stay there a little bit, and then they're on their way back, and the sun is setting, and they need to stop off. They have the option. There's a lad. He gives them the option to turn into the Yevusi city, which we know to be Yerushalayim, but it was not yet a Jewish city. I posed it as an extra credit question. To my family at home, to my kids, when Avram Avinu is told in Bris Vayin Abisarim about the various nations that he's going to be in, given over their land, so the last nation mentioned is the Yevusim. So I just posed the extra credit question, which I didn't get an answer to yet. Is that because they were the last, meaning if Yerushalayim is kind of the last piece for David to conquer, is that maybe why it's mentioned last, because they were the last nation to give over the control? But they have the option of going to this Yevusi city, and the Ish Levi says he doesn't want to go there. He wants to go to a Jewish city, and they end up in Giva, which is in the territory of Binyamin. And they come there, and we see them in the city square, and no one is providing them any hospitality. doesn't appear to be any inn, any place to pay. Rather, they were relying on hospitality and nothing was coming their way until this elder gentleman, this older man, is coming from the field. Ends up, he says he's also from the Har Ephraim. He's not native to the city, which is maybe why he has a chesed component. He's willing to be kind. He's willing to be machnes orchim. And the last words that we read last time is that he basically had responded back to the Ish Levi saying, by the way, you said you have all your provisions, you just need a place to stay. No, you're going to stay with me, and all of your, I'm going to take care of everything. So Pasuk Chaf Aleph is where we are continuing our study. Vayivi'ehu leveso. He brings him into his home, and him, again, is the Ish Levi, his Pilegesh wife, his concubine wife, and his attendant. Vayaval lechamorim. Interesting use of word to provide provision and sustenance for the donkeys. The Metsudos Tzdavid, which is where the commentary is more on the conceptually what's going on, he uses the phrase tikein hama'achal lechamorim to prepare, to set the food for the donkeys. When the Art Scroll translates this with the word prepare, what do we have any other translations? Non-Art Scroll? To prepare, to set food, to mix food maybe? Mixed fodder. So that's the interesting term yaval. Comes from the word balal, bilbul. These are words that are all related to each other. Goes back to to Bavel, the origins of Bavel, the city of Bavel came because that's where the tradition was that all the dead of the flood ended up in Bavel. It was this big bilbul. Eventually, you fast forward, one of the reasons why we call the Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud, it's not only because it was in Bavel, but it had this element of bilbul. It has an element of mixture because it was 300 years of conversations that took place in various Bate Midrashim in Bavel, so it's like a mixture. And balul means to be mixed. We have that phrase used in the context of halacha by a karban mincha. By a karban mincha, their requirement, there are about 9 different types of flour offerings that involve flour, F-L-O-U-R. Many of them require oil. And it's the application of oil takes place in three different stages, and there's a concept of balila, of mixing the oil into the flour. That's kind of where this terminology comes from. And so the Mitzvah Tzion, when he's defining the term, says the word vayaval comes from bilbul, which is to mix, and basically to mix the animal feed together. So not really significant for this pasuk, but it's a word that comes up in Tanakh. And even in rabbinic Hebrew, to mix together. What is, you know, we note that while we're going to be, there's going to be a lot of negativity in this perek, but there's a lot, you know, there are pockets of positivity. We're going to see the order is, vayava lechamorim, that's like the first half of the pasuk, right? He invites them in, and he feeds the animals. Then, vayirchatsu raglehem, he washes their feet, meaning the people. Vayochlu vayishtu, he gives them to eat and them to drink, which actually follows the pattern of the Torah. The Torah requires the owner of an animal to take care of their animals first before they take care of themselves. And, you know, kind of patterning here, right, to give the animals first is the Torah value. And so this pasuk is highlighting that. Then take care of the people, they wash their feet, they eat, they drink. They seem to be settling in nicely. So much so that in Pasuk Chaf Beis, their situation is described in a very, almost you would almost say, poetic way. We're talking about people who are basically just staying the night in someone's house before they go on, right? They're staying in the Motel 6 of that time. Obviously, we pointed out that there wasn't anywhere for pay. But this is not supposed to be something where this is luxurious in any way. But the Tanakh chooses to describe their reaction to having been fed and having been given to drink, hema metivim elibam. They were good to the heart. The art school wants to translate it. They were feeling merry. It's a little bit similar. It's a little bit similar to the language that was used earlier in the perek when he was still by the house of his of the Pilegesh's father, and he's giving them to write. The pasuk was, he asks him to stay, v'yitev libecha, your heart will be good. So there, the language, we kind of understand the very comfortable, almost luxurious type of language of how they felt, because he was in his quasi-father-in-law's home, and the father-in-law was going out of his way to make them feel welcome, maybe wanting him to stay, having so much hakar satov that he's taking back the daughter as a pilegesh. You would not have necessarily expected such language here, meaning they got their provisions, or just say they were satiated. But to say that they were mitivim alibam, it may be to kind of draw the contrast, because what's about to happen and the interaction that's about to happen is going to be so horrific that even if all they had was plain sustenance and kind of just okay provisions, that, you know, relative to what is, God forbid, you know, what's about to happen, it's considered to be luxurious. Or you could also say that they actually received an extremely high level of hachnasas orchim from this old man who came from the field. And that's also, again, to be understood in contrast to how the other inhabitants of the city are going to treat them. V'hinei anshei ha'ir. Behold, the men of the city, Anshei Belial, already described as lawless and baseless individuals. Does that mean that it is everyone? Does that mean that it is a smaller group? We're not exactly sure. And most likely, the fact that the Tanakh is choosing to call them Anshei Bnei Belial is not just based on thinking, you know, kind of in retrospect, after seeing what they did, they become Anshei Belial. It seems that the Tanakh is presenting them that their current persona, their current description before the atrocities of Perek Yotes is that they were Anshei Belial. We're going to see a number of thematic and linguistic connections to actually our Torah reading this week in Parshas Vayera in terms of when the Malachim come to Sodom. And the people of Sodom gather against the house of Lot. So there, the language is more expansive. By lot, it speaks about everyone, like from young to old. It makes it sound like the whole city is in on, you know, the terrible behavior that they would in theory like to put forward in Parshas Vayera. Here, it might be a smaller group. It just uses a generic term of Anshei Ha'ir, so we don't know how many they are. Nasabu es habayis. They surrounded the house. Misdapkim al hadelas. And they're banging on the door. They're knocking on the door. Dofik, which means to knock or to hit against a door. We have that in Shir HaShirim called Dodi Dofik, the beloved, my beloved was knocking in Parakeh of Shir HaShirim, when the beloved and the maiden, they're never able to meet in Shir HaShirim. They're always missing each other. Parakeh has it the scene that's kind of the starkest is that the beloved is knocking at the door and the maiden takes time to get dressed and put on the slippers and get to the door, and by the time she gets to the door, the beloved is gone. So kol dodi dofek, the dofek means to knock against the door. Vayomru, and they say el ha'ish bal habayis hazaken lemor. So the men of the town, they're turning to the man, the owner of the house, this elderly gentleman who had come from the field, and they say as following. Hotzei es ha'ish asher ba'el beischa v'nei da'enu. Bring forth the man that has come to your house, v'nei adenu, that we shall know him. Now apparently they must have had some level of intel that someone is in the house, that there's a guest in the house. So that when we kind of, when we were learning the psukim last week, how the Ish Levi and his concubine and the Nar, how they're in the city square and no one's offering them anything, but everybody's observing. Everyone sees them, everyone knows them, knows that they're around, and they're demanding the man to be brought out, v'nei da'enu, that we shall know him. Rashi, Mitzudas Tzion, defined the term ne'adenu like the biblical, right, Vayeda Adam as Chava Ishto, that Adam knew Chava, which means to be intimate. The normally the Torah makes use of that term for normal intimacy between a man and a woman. Here, they're borrowing the language. They wanted to have a level of intimacy with this man, with, right, and we're talking about Anshei Ha'ir. The Radak wants to explain it not only in the sense of that we have a biblical concept of that yada, to know someone, can be in an intimate way, but he wants that maybe you could say from the future psukim when the owner of the house is going to offer something else, which is in the intimate category, and it's there to kind of take the place of this, we can kind of learn backwards and see what they were intending. The Radak also says that there may be an element of, and this is based on when the Ish Levi eventually talks about this experience, we'll have to see that's in Parak Chaf, but when he talks about the experience, there are parts of what he says which he seems to be speaking the truth, and there are parts where he kind of covers the truth. One of the parts where he perhaps, according to the Radak, is speaking the truth is that there was a request. This request of v'nei adenu also involves not just being intimate with the individual, but eventually taking their life. And the Radak speaks of an idea that maybe it was that since this Ish Levi would have to kind of give up his life rather than put himself in such a situation, then maybe it would mean that they were even willing to take his life, and there may be an element of that. So therefore, when he speaks about the situation and when he revisits and retells the story, he retells it under a certain threat of death, which may have actually been there present from the beginning. So that's this is their demand that they're making upon the owner of the house. Pasachav Gimel. Vayetze aleihem o'ish balabayis. So the balabayis, he comes out to them. He must feel that it's safe enough maybe for him to come out, or it's worthwhile for him to come out to try and save his guest. Vayomar aleihem, he says to them, al achai, al tareyuna. Do not, my brothers, do not do this evil. Do not do this. Do not be wicked. Tareu, do not become wicked. Do not do this evil act of taking advantage of my guest. After the fact that this man has come into my house, al ta'asu es nivala hazos. Don't do this disgusting naval, nivela. Don't do this disgusting act. Which again, that's one of the ways the Radak is using the second pasuk to interpret the first one. They're asking to do something that's disgusting. He does not. It's interesting. He doesn't. The owner of the home. He doesn't say don't do this only because it's wrong. It seems to be on the one hand we're a fan of him, right? He's on the one hand he's putting forward what sounds to be a moral argument. Don't do the wrong thing. Don't do the evil thing. Don't do the disgusting thing. But it's a warped type of morality because he's saying after the fact that he's my guest, so it's almost like he's implying it would be okay to do it to a random stranger. It would be okay to do this to someone else, but not my guest, which is a warped way of morality. And we know that once in human history, once you start viewing things through your own sense of what is moral and what is not moral, so you could make the argument that any activity is moral and any activity is immoral. When you have the prism of what the Torah says is moral and what the Torah says is not moral, so then you're kind of then it's objective, it's not subjective, and therefore it should just be al tasu es nivala hazos, period. It shouldn't be because he's a guest. It should be because the Torah says not to do such a thing. As if that wasn't enough, his warped sense of what is moral is even further, I guess, warped in Pasuk Chaf Dalet. Hine biti besula. He says, behold, I have a daughter who's a besula, who's a virgin. Upilak shehu. And the man who you're looking for, his concubine. Otsia na osam. I'll bring these two women out to you. Va'anu osam. And you can inflict them with pain. The anu is a language of basically it's torture, it's pain, and it's being used even though you would say the Mitzudos Tzion tells us it's a euphemism for being intimate in a forceful way. The fact that there's an element of pain there may be a little bit of foreshadowing what happens, because the end result is an act or acts of sexual violence where there is an extreme amount of pain, and presumably that wasn't in the mind of this of the Baal HaBayis who's offering this kind of sick deal to the mob that's surrounding the house. But he's saying, I have a daughter, she's a besula. There is this woman who's a pilegesh. I'm going to bring them out. Otsia na osam, va'anu osam, you'll be able to have them. Va'asula hem atov b'nechem, you'll do to them what is good in your eyes. But, ule ish hazeh, lo sasu davar hanivala hazos, you shouldn't do this disgusting act. Which again is this warped sense of morality, because however you want to understand the pilegesh, right? If we're pilegesh, most likely there still is an element of eshes ish. She's a taken woman. She's a married woman. Okay, she's not married with kiddushin and with ksuba, but she's a married woman. And the besula, she's his daughter. We would imagine that she's a single girl. And to go ahead and force themselves upon them and to commit these acts of sexual violence is not a nevala. You know,
is that strange that this is so similar to Lot and his daughters?
So there are many, many similarities to Lot and the daughters. and to the scene of Lot, right? Lot is the host. He's trying to protect his guests. It is, right, the mob is asking for sexual violence against men. What's being attempted to be bartered is women. Somehow in that warped sense of morality, it makes it better. In Sodom, it never comes to be. In Sodom, because Sodom had a magic card of they were dealing with malachim who were, malachim, angels. So therefore, they were able to quote unquote save the day, and the atrocity doesn't happen. In our story, the atrocity and it ends up happening. I think you can sit there and it's very fitting. They're both parakeet tests, actually. So it's very fitting. This week you could die. I guess as little as we would want to revisit this perek and that episode in Sodom, the fact that we're learning both Parsha Shavua and there, it's definitely, I guess, in a weird way fitting. I think the best takeaway is we understand what the morality of Sodom and the morals of Sodom was at that time, and it becomes indicative of the fact that Sodom had to be destroyed. Sodom had to be become so immoral that it couldn't be saved anymore. That doesn't happen here in the same way with Hashem giving forward a punishment. But if the overall theme of Pilegesh Begiva is to highlight the lack of morals among the people, so we're doing that, right? If you don't want to be compared to Sodom, right? You don't want to have the story in Tanakh that Europe matched up with is a city that had to be destroyed. When Avram is negotiating, they can't even find 10 people in the city who are worth saving. Obviously, from some cosmic perspective, Lot and his family was worthy of being saved, whether it had anything to do with them or just the fact that he's still riding on the coattails of Avraham Avinu. But Lot deserved to be saved, and there's something very mystical about Lot being saved and Lot with his daughters when his daughters take him in a physical union and produces children, it produces Moab, and Moab ends up producing Rus, and Rus David, and David Mashiach. So it's very hard to fully understand and appreciate why, that route had to happen. But the similarities, I think, highlight how negative this was. And again, whether this story, we keep circling back to this idea, but whether the story of Pilegesh Begiva happened at the beginning of the time period of the Shoftim, the end of the time period of the Shoftim, it highlights what not having a central leadership and a proper king meant for the land. So he makes them this offer, saying, take my daughter, take the man's Pilegesh, and do what's good in your eyes, but don't do something bad to this man. Without any, right, it would appear, based on, we're working with the psukim that we have, it would appear he didn't sit and come up with this plan with the Ish Levi, right? We don't know much about the Ish Levi yet, right? Till now he's like, as I guess, a so-so character, and he's about to become a horrific character and someone who we're going to hate or despise. But what gives the right for the Baal HaBayis, for the man to say, better that you take his wife rather than you take him. He's playing with his own sense of what's moral and what's less moral, so therefore he just says whatever comes to his mind. Pasuk Chafhei v'lo avu hanashim l'shmala. The men do not want to listen to him. They don't want to listen to him. They don't want to take his offer. Vayachazek ha'ish bepilag sho. And here, what's clear is that the subject changes. While in the previous pasuk, it uses the word the one who's speaking is the Baal HaBayis. Vayachazek ha'ish bepilag sho. The man takes hold of his pilagesh. So we're talking about the Ish Levi. The Ish Levi takes hold of his own pilagesh. Vayotzi alei amachutz. And he brings the pilagesh out to them outside. Right? Kind of like throws her out to them and closes the door. And what's crazy, the whole thing's crazy. But at this point, he's a scoundrel because he's willing to sacrifice his own wife to try to protect himself. What's wild is, which you know, it you can't necessarily explain it rationally, and most likely we can't explain it rationally because in no way, shape, or form are we dealing with rational people. They go with it. Vayedu osa, they know her, they start taking advantage of her sexually. They are tormenting her sexually the entire night until the morning. And they kind of just like throw her as the dawn comes. The host's daughter is not involved.
Right.
The host's daughter.
The Baal
Bais's
daughter.
Is not involved. The Baal Bais' daughter is not involved. It would appear that that the mob outside is quote unquote satisfied with receiving the Pilegesh, leaves everyone who's in the house, including the man that they were searching for, alone. And what's wild is that they were offered this and they said no to the offer. Then when we're clearly not dealing with human beings that are rational, with human beings that are living up to what it means to be a human being and not an animal. And it would almost appear like, you know, unfortunately, humans can behave like this, but you know, it's much easier to almost imagine you have a group of dogs that are extremely hungry, and they get thrown a piece of meat, and it's not the piece of meat that they wanted, but they got a piece of meat actually. It's not in theory anymore, so they like rabid dogs, they just focus on that, and they almost forget about what they had wanted. That's the way this scene kind of is being depicted, because they were offered, and it, you know, even it's hard to understand because it's so not human to do this to another person. But even you know, from a certain sense, they were offered two ladies, and they were okay with just one. And there's such a level of depravity here that you know, there's no sense of, you know, there's no way to call this a crime of passion. A crime of passion is in passing between one person and another. This is a crime of intense lacking of any sense of what is right, of what the Torah demands, of what just human decency demands. And it even goes down until even like the way that every aspect of it is described, and you know, maybe, you know, obviously you have to say that this was written b'nevuah hundreds of years later by Shmuel HaNavi, but even the fact that it ends with vayishalchua, they just like threw her like she was nothing to them. And obviously, the way that they treated her highlighted the fact that she was nothing to them. Pasuk chavav, vatavoha isha lefnos haboker. The woman was able to somehow, as we'll see, somehow she was able to walk a little bit. Vatavoha isha lefnos haboker, as it was turning to morning, right? A lot of times we have that phrase lefnos erev. We have that phrase when evening is turning, right? The word poneh means to turn, because well, first of all, the world actually turns, so somehow, but even the darkness turns to light, the light turns to dark. And dusk and dawn are similar times in terms of what the sky looks like, and so you can have a similar description. So it was before morning. Vatipol pesach beis ha'ish asher adonai hasham ad ha'or. She fell onto the doorway of the man of the house that her master, meaning her husband, Adonai, her husband, her master, who was there, she fell there at Aor until the morning. She couldn't bring herself to knock at the door. She couldn't bring herself to get any further assistance. In case a horrific tragedy, you know, wasn't tragic enough, she can't even make it in to get an ounce of rest or an ounce of help at all. Pasuk of Zion, Vayakam Adoneha, her master got up, and what's fascinating, maybe, is that after he treats her the way that he treats her,
he went to sleep.
Well, not only that, but the Tanakh starts referring to him in a different way. Now, all of a sudden, he's Adoneha. He had not referred to him in that way before. He didn't treat her like a Pilegesh. He didn't treat her like a concubine, like a quasi-wife. There's a huge difference between not giving her a ksuba and treating her the way that he treated her. There's a difference between not having kiddushin with her and treating her the way that he treated her, basically sacrificing her to save himself, and the fact that at no point is he even looking for her. At no point, it's like he's really gotten rid of her, which it definitely boggles the mind. This is the woman that you schlepped to Beis Lechem to bring back into your life. I didn't see many types of many versions of attempts to explain his psyche. And again, he may be falling into the category of an irrational person and someone who, you know, you can't enter their psyche. You can't try to understand what they're thinking. So Vayakam Pasach Zayin, Vayakam Adonai Baboker, Vayiftach Dal Sos HaBayis. He opens up the doors of the house. Vayetze Laleches Ladarko. He's going, right, crazy. Vayetze Laleches Ladarko. He's going out not to look for his Pilegesh, not to see if she's okay. He's going out to go on his way. V'hinei Ha'isha Pilegesho Nofeles Pesach HaBayis. And behold, his wife, the Pilegesh, had fallen onto the doorway of the house. V'yodeh ad hasaf, her hand is like on the threshold. The saf comes. There's a more elaborate word, definitely in rabbinic Hebrew. I don't know if it's ever used in Tanakh this way. The askufa. Mitzudos Sion says the askufa is like the area of the doorway, the space there. And the samach and the fei come from, I guess, are related to that word. The Mitzudas Tzion ends up quoting a pasuk in Yeshaya that refers to the mezuzos, the doorposts, right? So every doorway is made up of two mezuzos and a mashkof, a lintel. Two mezuzos and we know that from Hilchas Mezuzah. If you're missing those things, you're missing doorposts, you're missing a lintel, then there's no need to have mezuzah. When something goes all the way up to the ceiling, no need to have a mezuzah. So saf refers to that area of the doorway, and you know it's like it seems to be tragically poetic that like her she almost made it. Her hand is like on the is in that space. It just keeps getting. I mean, it can't really get worse, but at least our feelings about this ish, about the ish Levi, they get worse. Pasuk Chafches, Vayomer Eleha, he says to her, Kumi Vinelcha, get up, let's go. That's his first words to this person who, even if he made the decision to sacrifice her on behalf of himself, he should have a warped sense of Hakar Satov. He should, right? She saved his life. And he says, come, get up, let's go. Ve'enonesh, he doesn't answer. Rashi says, Kimesa, she had died. Ve'yichachea alachamor, he takes her upon the donkey, on his donkey. Ve'yakam ha'ish ve'yilch lemkomo. And he goes, he gets up and he goes to his place. He goes back to his town. He goes back to the foothills of Har Ephraim. And if he's going to be horrified at what happened, so from a From a certain perspective, what the people of Giva, these Anshei Belial, what they did was wrong. And what they did is horrific. But what he did is no less, perhaps, horrific from a certain perspective, that he sacrificed his own wife. He fed her to the wolves. But he's not going to be willing to look internally. He's not going to be willing to look at his own fault, and he's only going to seek some form of justice from what he thinks was the great injustice, which is, it's another example of a relative morality, and that it could very well be, again, the theme seems, whenever we're told that there's no king, we're told with the phrase, each man does what's straight in his eyes. Each man does what's straight in his eyes. That is a way to describe this a relative morality. And so, without having that central authority of a king, with what comes with it, is a little bit of a sense of fear of the king, and therefore applying the king's version of what is moral, which one hopes in the Torah society is the Torah's version of what's moral. That's why the Torah demands of the king that he has, in addition to the regular Sefer Torah that everyone is supposed to write, the last mitzvah in the Torah, the king is supposed to write an additional that you know, kind of always goes out with him. And the Gemara is very clear that if a king had a situation where he inherited the Torah, a Torah from his father, it's not good enough. He has to write his own Torah. He has to write his own Torah is a sense of he has to have his own forging of making sure that the ideals and the values of Hashem's Torah become his. You can't be a king who observes Hashem's Torah because your father did. There's some level of each person, right? Each person, you know, we can't expect our children to automatically become servants of Hashem. That's why we educate them. That's why we bring them up with a Jewish education. The hope and the prayer is at some point they go from this passive Eved Hashem who worships Hashem because their parents told them to being an active, right? They worship Hashem because they want to, right? So maybe it's at whatever developmental stage, but eventually children are standing on their own. They're out of the house. They're on their own. And the choice of whether they observe the mitzvot or not is going to be up to them, no matter what their parent wants. So there's an aspect of us all having, needing to write our own Sefer Torah. But the king, for sure, has to write his own Sefer Torah. The king has to lead with a sense of what is moral from the Torah's perspective. And then it has an impact on the country. The fact that we're dealing with the story of an individual who's kind of ruling his own life with his own morals is, again, one of the downsides of not having a proper unified government ruling Eretz Yisrael from a Torah perspective. So he's back home. Pasuk Chavtes. Vayovel b'so, he comes to his actual house. Vayikach es ha-ma'acheles. He takes a ma'acheles. Ma'acheles is another term in Tanakh for a knife. That's the same term that's used by the Akedah. It obviously has the word ma'acheles. It brings the ability for you to eat because it is a tool that's used for eating. Why particularly a knife would be used that way is a good question. I didn't take the time to do this. So if you want homework assignment, you can look at anywhere in Tanakh, other places in Tanakh. In addition, right here, it's being used as knife. There in actually also this week's parsha, right by Yera, this week's parsha again by the Akedah, it's also used as knife. Does the word ma'acheles come up other places in Tanakh? Is it ever used as any other form of kind of eating or food preparation utensil, or is it unique to a knife? And then the question would kind of have to be, you know, where does that why would that be? I'm not sure. I'm making this up on the spot right now. We have a name for the nicks on a knife. What's the name? Sometimes we refer to a knife having teeth. And I wonder if there's any type of connection that what the knife does is almost similar to what the mouth does, just kind of as a pre, you know, to prepare it. And maybe there's some level of, that's why the knife functions more so than a fork. Because what does a fork do? A fork just holds something in place. It doesn't actually change anything to the item. But the same way that when a person chews food, he or she breaks it down into smaller pieces, that's what a knife can do. So the Ish Levi, he takes the knife, and he takes hold of the body of his concubine wife, he cuts her according to her bones or according to her limbs, 12 sections, 12 cuts or 12 pieces. And he sends her body to all throughout the boundaries of Israel. There are different interpretations. Is it that he took the 12 tribes and particularly not the tribe of Binyamin, as we'll see, because he has something against the tribe of Binyamin, and therefore he sent it to 12 tribes, meaning he included, let's say, the tribe of Levi, even though they don't have a set place. But he included the tribe of Levi, so he's sending 12. And then is it that he sent one body part by itself? Or another interpretation is that he sent all 12 to basically see this horrific, jarring scene. And he's trying to bring the people to a sense of disgust and a sense that they need to stand up for something, that an atrocity was done. Now, why he chooses to do this, there doesn't seem to be a parallel in Tanakh previous to this. And definitely, you know, again, we have this relative morality. This is anti the Torah, right? The Torah tells us in the context of someone that is put to death by Beis Din, so the Torah tells us, "Kavor tikbarenu bayomahu," you shall surely bury the individual on that day. So much so that there was an element that certain types of misas Beis Din, when the court would put you to death. So after they put you to death for a very limited amount of time, they would hang the body, almost as a public example. You know, don't be like that person. Certain offenses. But it was never to be. It was never for the body to remain there overnight. And the Torah has this value of kavor tikbarenu bayomahu. You should bury them on that day. We believe in the value of burial. Number one, that there be burial, and that we believe in the value of being buried as quickly as possible. And if that's what we say about an individual who is chayiv misa, so of course we say that about a person who's an upstanding citizen. In the United States of America, we have certain limitations. At least most of the cemeteries that we use in the United States of America have certain limitations. Our brothers and sisters in Monroe, the Satmar community, they kind of own their own community. They own their own cemeteries. They hire the workers. They do everything. It's not unionized. And so they can have a burial at night. They can have a burial, kavor tekvenu bayimahu. We know these things in Eretz Yisrael. A person, God forbid, can pass away at 7 p.m. and by 11 o'clock they're doing a funeral and in the night with the lights with it, because it's not right. So from a certain perspective, it sounds cold. It sounds wrong. You know, wait for people till they can gather together and word can get out. It's because they're not dealing with morality on it. That's the way we would think, which has certain value, but that's not the way the Torah thinks. Kavor tikbarenu bayomahu. So what gave him the right to do such a thing? It's called Nival Hames. We have in Eretz Yisrael, they fought long and hard for this, that there shouldn't be autopsies, and it happens in America if there are certain situations where there's going to be. We consider once a person unfortunately is no longer alive, so that's it. They're no longer alive. Until that point, we do everything to save the life. But once a person's not alive, they're not alive. So then anything you do could be an issue of nivol hames. It could be an issue of causing a desecration to the body, which is not a Torah value. So what gave, what this was not allowed. not, you know, almost nothing has been allowed. So it doesn't come to a surprise. There's definitely an idea of showing that right now there's a sense of disunity. The fact that he takes a body, a unified body, and he cuts it into pieces is that it's symbolic of an idea that Klal Yisrael at this time is not unified, and that if Klal Yisrael was unified, maybe an atrocity like this would not happen. There is debate whether or not he attached a scroll of some sort or a letter of some sort to give some context. Is it that he gave a version of the story of what happened together with this, you know, kind of delivery that or what's being sent? Or is it no? Is it basically he's going for extreme shock and almost getting interest that way? Meaning people are going to want to know where did this come from and almost getting the interest of this is something that's extremely horrific. What's a little bit, I guess, in a slightly more positive way, in a certain sense, from like a Tanakh perspective, poetic, is that this scene is repeated, not in its horrificness, but the scene of sending a message via cutting something into pieces is repeated in the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, or I guess the middle section of Shmuel Aleph. The first act of Shaul as king was to go to war to protect a town that had been threatened by a foreign king. This king Nachash, who was an Ammonite, who was from Ammon, he threatened a town called Yavesh Gilad, if I'm not mistaken, and he gave them a week to listen, give in to his threat. And word got to Shaul, and Shaul HaMelech took an animal, cut the animal into 12 pieces, sent it around, basically sending the message, I am the unified leader, and we are going to act as one unified group. And some of the Mefarshim explain there what Shaul was trying to do is to, in a certain way, he was trying to channel Pilegesh Begiva and rectify it. That there was a time that Klal Yisrael was not unified and did not do the proper thing on behalf of someone who's threatened or was threatened, and now with a unified king, and Shaul brings a force of like 330 soldiers together to do what's proper and to do what's right. So there is a but so there. Even there, you know, so I guess that the animal activists could be upset, but you're trying, right? You're in a situation, right? Shaul was in a situation. Perhaps you have to say it's a pekuach nefesh type of situation. Now, obviously, could he have riled the troops in some other, you know, way, shape, or form? You know, probably, but this was you know, that was the way that Shaul chose. And maybe, you know, again, Shaul's situation is dealing with, there's no precedent to follow. There has never been a united king, and so they need to, he maybe needs to do something in a drastic way to make a point. I don't, you know, the classical Mefarshim don't take him to task for doing what he did. Pasuk Lamed, V'haya kol haro'eh v'amar lo niyasa. The lo nir asa kazos, l'miyom alos b'nei Yisrael me'eretz Mitzrayim ad hayom hazeh. And it was kol ro'eh, all who saw it, all who took hold of either one of these body parts or all of them, va'amar, they would naturally say to themselves, it sounds like, lo niyasa, it never was. Lo nir asa, it has never been seen. Kazos, like this, miyom alos b'nei Yisrael me'eretz Mitzrayim, from the time that Klal Yisrael came to up from Eretz Mitzrayim ad hayom hazeh until today, simu lachem aleha, kind of like pay attention to it, atzu v'daveru, take counsel and speak up. So, on the one hand, this almost sounds like if everyone had the same reaction, Maybe there was some type of description that was attached to, right, and some type of messaging. Or, you say that just the fact that you know, kind of you take their words at face value, they're basically saying we've never seen such a thing. We've never seen a dismembered individual, we're not talking about a battlefield of war where, you know, there are soldiers that got dismembered. We're talking about this was deliberate, and they're almost taking this like Jewish history perspective. Now again, according to the Mefarshim that say that this happened more towards the beginning, you're still dealing with a good amount of time of Jewish history, because they're not just saying anything about Klal Yisrael entering the land. They're going back l'miyom alos bnei Yisrael me'eretz Mitzrayim. They're going back to even when the Jews left Mitzrayim. So you're talking about the 40 years in the desert. You're talking about definitely the 24 years that Yehoshua leads them, and then some time period either at the beginning of the Shoftim. So you're talking about a significant amount of time of history, and yet they're saying that something like this has never happened. They're almost calling to, right, going back, l'miyom alos b'nei Yisrael me'eretz Mitzrayim. Leaving Egypt was supposed to be for a higher calling. Leaving Egypt was supposed to, right, you're supposed to leave the Maasei Mitzrayim, you're supposed to leave the ways of Egypt behind. That's there are countless times that Klal Yisrael in the desert is told not to mimic what they saw in Mitzrayim. Similarly, they're told not to follow the ways of Canaan. There's meant to be a Jewish way or a Torah way, the path that they're supposed to be on, and something like this has never been seen, which therefore is calling to question that we need to react to this. Simu lachem aleha, kind of pay attention to it. Utsu v'daberu, to do two things. Utsu is to, right, from the language of Eitza, to take advice, to take counsel. Vidaberu, and speak up. You would have maybe thought to have a different, right? It should be like Utsu Vidaberu, and then Va'asu, and then take action. It could very well be that it's implying that by saying to speak up, it's implying that actions would be had, and that there would be some level of not letting it go and stepping up to the plate. Now, that element of not letting it go and stepping up to the plate, if you would be able to find, if you'd be able to find Jews in the country willing to step up, willing to have this reaction, so in that you definitely do see a glimmer of hope. You see a glimmer of hope if that there's a terrible atrocity on a moral level happening in one part of the country, but the rest of the country is ready to, or at least a good part of the country is ready to stand up for that. So in that action of standing up, there's something that's positive. We may see that in the way that they stood up, in the way that they went about it, it might not have been in the best light, and that unfortunately, it's possible that nobody's a winner. It's possible that when all is said and done, the story of Pelegash Begeva, no one's a hero. No one comes out being positive. And the entire story paints this broad picture of, you know, the people lacking morals and the people lacking leadership. So Be'ez Hashem, next time we will continue with Perek Chaf.